we've already talked about Barton W. Stone. We've spent some time talking about Thomas Campbell, and we've seen some of the things that they wrote. Barton W. Stone, the most famous thing that he wrote was The Last Will and Testament of Springfield Presbytery. Then Thomas Campbell wrote concerning the Christian Association of Washington. Both of them come from Presbyterian backgrounds. Of course, Barton W. Stone was kind of from a more mainstream Presbyterian background. Thomas Campbell is from a breakaway, a splinter group of the Presbyterians, but Presbyterians no less. We'll start talking about James O'Kelly tonight. He's the third person that we're going to talk about. Now, James O'Kelly is in doing his work in Virginia and North Carolina. And James O'Kelly comes not from the Presbyterian background, but instead comes from a Methodist background. I say that because it's just interesting to me that you had people from all different kinds of backgrounds that were independently coming to many of the same conclusions at about the same time. And then all of these people started to meet each other, kind of, it was almost serendipitous that they met each other. And they kind of coalesced into a large formation that ultimately resulted in people deciding that they would be called Christians and nothing else, and that they would call their congregations Churches of Christ or Christian churches. So let's talk a little bit about James O'Kelly and what his background was. He's a little bit before Stone and Campbell, although they overlap. They are contemporaries. James O'Kelly was born and started his work prior to Stone and Campbell. He's born in 1738, died in 1826. He is a Methodist circuit riding preacher. Now, the circuit riders, the Methodists tended not to have located preachers who worked with a single congregation exclusively. Instead, they had preachers who would cover all of the congregations in an area, and they would be in this city this week, another city next week, another city next week. So in 1774, O'Kelly is converted. Now remember, he's born in 1774, so he is about 30 years old. He's converted, and he becomes a lay preacher in the Methodist Church in North Carolina. So he's not an ordained minister, just a lay preacher. What that meant was O'Kelly could not, in the Methodist church, participate or officiate or offer sacraments. He couldn't marry people. He couldn't preside at a burial. He couldn't serve the Lord's Supper. He couldn't baptize people. Now, of course, O'Kelly never did baptize. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But when he first started, he's just a lay preacher. He's just a fellow who preaches, and he rides a circuit. Can't supervise the offering of the sacraments. So in 1779, 5 years after he started preaching, he's now moved up to Virginia from North Carolina. And a group of, I think it was 28 preachers, got together in, there's the name of the town, Fluvanna, maybe, Fluvanna, or knowing how they talk in Virginia, Fluvanna, Virginia. And they decided that somebody needed to administer the sacraments, so they ordained themselves. They ordained each other. And that's how they began offering the sacraments on the western frontier in 1779. Well, there were some northern preachers up in Boston, Baltimore, in those areas, who were opposed to what O'Kelly and this group of Virginia circuit preachers had done, and they met in Baltimore for a general convention of Methodist churches. So they opposed the action of the Virginia preachers. And depending on who you read, if you read Asbury, who is the leader of the northern bunch of preachers, if you read Asbury, he wanted to send word to John Wesley, who is still in England, and ask him what should be done about this situation. If you read what James O'Kelly wrote, James O'Kelly wanted to send word to England and ask what should be done at the hand of John Wesley. John Wesley had been the primary force in organizing the Methodist Church. So, however it happened, the two sides agreed that they would submit the issue to John Wesley to find out whether this was legitimate, that these guys had just gone off and they had ordained themselves so that they could offer the sacraments. So on December the 25th, 1784, there is a conference that's held. It's called the Christmas Conference. As I went through James O'Kelly's life and I was trying to pick out the things that I thought were important, it seems like an awful lot of things in James O'Kelly's life happened on December the 25th. And I think that was just because the Methodists tended to gather at the end of the year. And that's when a lot of these things happened. This one, a lot happened at this conference in 1784. And it became a famous conference. It's kind of called the Christmas Conference, although there were a lot of other conferences that were held around Christmas. So anyway, at this one in 1784, John Wesley, who is in England, he's the founder of Wesleyanism or Methodism, he sends a letter to the American Methodist churches. And he tells them two really important things. First, you guys are over in America, I'm in England, you guys are independent. You guys make your own decisions, choose your own direction. And the second thing he did was he said, Francis Asbury is going to be the head of the American Methodist Church. So he just appointed Francis Asbury. And so Asbury, well, he appointed two people, Asbury and Thomas Cook, Francis Asbury and Thomas Cook. But Asbury is the one who kind of becomes the spokesman for the two of them. And then that conference elected O'Kelly as an elder. Apparently, they recognized his ordination as a preacher, and he is elected as an elder. So from 1785 to 1792, you have Asbury, who is the superintendent, and when Asbury writes about the Christmas conference and what went on there, he's the first one that refers to himself as the bishop. So he calls himself the bishop, and in reality, Jonathan Wesley had called him a superintendent, but he decides that he is going to now be the bishop of the American Methodist Church. 1785 to 1792, O'Kelly is what's called, he's elected to be a presiding elder. And what that meant was he was over a group of circuit riding preachers, at times as many as 28 circuit riding preachers in Southern Virginia would answer to Thomas O'Kelly, to James O'Kelly, not Thomas O'Kelly. Now, Asbury, by all accounts, even if you read the records of the Methodist Church about this period of time, Asbury is, generally speaking, described as a harsh man. He's kind of autocratic, dictatorial. And for Asbury, he thinks of himself as the bishop, as the head of the American Methodist Church, and it's going to be my way or no way. And one of the things that really rankled some of the circuit riding preachers was that Asbury took it upon himself to tell circuit preachers where they could and could not preach. So he assigned them to locations. And he scheduled what they were going to do and when they were going to do it. Now, that really bugged O'Kelly. It bugged a lot of the preachers, the circuit preachers, but it really bugged O'Kelly. And in one of the Methodist conferences, O'Kelly suggested that if a preacher was assigned to a circuit that he didn't want to have, he didn't want to preach there, he could apply for reassignment to a different circuit. That made Asbury mad. Asbury rejected the suggestion outright, and that's what led O'Kelly to come to the conclusion that God never intended for one man to be over multiple congregations. He argued that Asbury and Coke couldn't serve together. They were elected as superintendents, but it really bothered O'Kelly that Asbury set himself up as being the bishop. So in 1792, at the conference, O'Kelly walked out. When Asbury wouldn't even consider his suggestion, O'Kelly just had enough, and he walked out of the conference, along with about half of the other preachers that were at the conference. And in 1793, O'Kelly and the rest of the group that was with O'Kelly in Virginia, basically, and North Carolina, organized into what they called the Republican Methodist Church. So it's a split from Asbury and the American Methodists. They didn't drop the name Methodist. They kept that for about the next 5 or 6 years. But now they wanted to refer to themselves as the Republican Methodist Church. Interestingly, one of the preachers that was at that conference in Manikintown, Virginia, was named Rice Haggard. If you've ever read about the American Restoration, Rice Haggard is a name that keeps popping up in different places. And this is where we get introduced to Rice Haggard. So O'Kelly and this group that included Rice Haggard called themselves Republican Methodists. They were called Republican Methodists because to them, the idea of Republican signified freedom. And it was basically their freedom to pursue Bible truths and Bible information and make a determination about it on their own. Now that sounds a lot like what we've seen with both Stone and Campbell. The name Republican Methodist didn't stick around for very long. They soon became known as the Free Methodists. But for them, Republican and free meant basically the same thing. That's not a way that we tend to use the idea of Republican very often anymore. But they're now called the Free Methodists, and they keep that name for about 5 or 6 years, and then that name is going to die out. Here's how the name kind of died out. They held a Free Methodist conference at Old Lebanon, and I don't know whether that's the name of a church or the name of a town, in Surry County, Virginia, in 1794. Rice Haggard is one of the members of the Free Methodist Conference, and he makes a suggestion that we ought to drop this name, Free Methodist Church, or Republican Methodist Church. And that hereafter, that group and the people associated with it should be called Christians. Simply Christians. No additions. Just Christians. Well, that was received really well. That was a suggestion from Rice Haggard. Everybody went with it. And the first church that was established that called itself Christian, that's it, was established in Flavana, or however you would say that if you lived in Virginia, Flavana, Virginia. Sounds like we're on the road to getting closer to the way that the church was described in the New Testament. 1804. Haggard and O'Kelly are now in Kentucky, and they are introduced to Barton W. Stone, who has been doing his work in Kentucky for the most part. And they were meeting at Cane Ridge. That's where Barton W. Stone preached. And what happened was that those two men, at least those two men, became associated with the Christians that were meeting at Cane Ridge. And that's reported, or there's an account of that in the Christian Messenger, which was a journal that was published around that period of time. There's an account of that meeting in 1826, 1827, that issue. Now, it had happened before that time, but that's where I get my information from, the Christian Messenger, 1826, 1827. So Kelly, it sounds like, has made an auspicious beginning. Well, O'Kelly and Haggard have made an auspicious beginning. They're rejecting denominational names, and they're getting back to simply being Christians. But then it went downhill from there. O'Kelly didn't stay at Cane Ridge. O'Kelly left Cane Ridge, but considered himself to be still associated with that group that was led by Barton W. Stone. In 1856, the Christian church that O'Kelly and Haggard had started formed the Southern Christian Convention. They brought together all of the congregations in that group. 1931, of course, this is well after the time that James O'Kelly has passed away, but the Southern Christian Convention, which is a group of Christian churches, merged with the Congregational Church, and they form what is now known as the Congregational Christian Church. And then in 1957, the Congregational Christian Church merged with the Evangelical and Reformed Church and became the United Church of Christ. So you can't freeze a moment in time when O'Kelly said, along with Rice Haggard, we should be called Christians and nothing else, and say O'Kelly has arrived, because O'Kelly kept evolving. And it's almost like what we saw with Barton W. Stone and the Springfield Presbytery. They were upset with the organization of the presbytery. A group, six preachers, left, and they formed the Springfield Presbytery. So they kind of moved this way, got a little closer, and then they decided, wait a minute, there's nothing that says that the Springfield Presbytery is any better than the old presbytery. We ought to quit being the Springfield Presbytery. So they willed the Springfield Presbytery to die. They moved a little closer. And they kind of stayed right there. O'Kelly, on the other hand, left the Methodist Church, developed the idea of the Christian Church, and then kept going. The pendulum kept swinging, and it swung too far to the other side. And they sort of formed their own association. Have trouble with the American Methodist Association, they formed their own association so they could do things the right way, not realizing that they just substituted one organization for another, and they shouldn't have had either kind of organization. That was kind of the story that you see repeated over and over again with these early restorationists. The problems that they had were with the organizational structure that existed in the large churches that they were a part of, the large denominations that they were a part of. And because they had a problem with the organizational structure, they left. Yeah, somebody had a comment.
Lee does.
Steve?
Yeah.
Was baptism ever an issue with either one of these men or the establishments of their re-establishments of their congregations or their churches?
Yeah, let me get to that. You introduced my next slide. Thank you, Lee. So these are the kinds of things that O'Kelly believed. He did teach that the Lord's Supper should be observed on the first day of every week. Unlike what had been practiced by Stone and Thomas Campbell, he did suggest that the church's work was to be supported only by free will offerings. Now, you remember one of the features of the Christian Association of Washington is that if you were going to be a member of the Christian Association of Washington, there was a membership fee, kind of like dues, that you had to pay. Well, O'Kelly would have rejected that churches work was to be supported only by the free will offerings of the members. In terms of what their assemblies looked like, O'Kelly described their assemblies and looks very much like what we're familiar with. There was singing, there was praying, and then they had O'Kelly called it preaching and admonishing the saints. I really can't tell you what the difference between the two was. O'Kelly, in everything that I read, he may have talked about that, but in everything that I read, he really didn't talk about the difference between preaching and admonishing the saints. I think that was, in my mind, the way that I think that this went. But understand, I'm imposing something that I think, because of what I'm familiar with, on people that lived 200 years ago, and that might not be appropriate. But it seems to me that they had preaching and then they had discipline associated with the Christians that were in a particular place. Maybe that's the difference between preaching and admonishing. I don't know. Now, O'Kelly was never immersed. In fact, in O'Kelly's apology, which he published under a pseudonym, he argued that baptism had nothing to do with membership in the church, that it was for believers, but it was not for the purpose of the forgiveness of sins. So O'Kelly writes, and he's very censorious of Elias Smith, who we'll see in just a minute. Elias Smith had argued that you needed to be baptized in order to be saved. Now, Elias Smith is associated with independent Baptist churches. And I'm not sure where Smith came from, but Smith advocated for baptism. O'Kelly never accepted baptism. And within the group, the Christian churches, sprinkling was practiced, never immersion. So even though they accepted the necessity of some baptism, it was sprinkling, number one, and number two, it was never associated with the forgiveness of sins. It was for those that were believers. So it's kind of what we tend to call an outward sign of an inward grace. Does that answer your question, Lee?
Yes, it did.
Yep. These guys didn't initially come to the notion of baptism. It was not until Alexander Campbell came from Scotland to the Americas, met up with his father, and together Alexander and Thomas, in their discussions, came to the conclusion that a man should be baptized for the remission of sins. And Alexander baptized Thomas, and Thomas baptized Alexander. Elias Smith and the independent Baptist churches were the ones who had the notion of baptism. They didn't have some of the other parts of this rite, but this is what O'Kelly is known for. And O'Kelly, remember, is one of the earliest of these restorationists. Now, he published what's called The Author's Apology for Protesting Against Methodist Episcopal Government in 1798. If you're interested, there's a link. You can look it up. I can't find that document in an easy to read format. The way that you're going to have to read that document is the way that they spelled things back then. F's look like S's. Oh, or S's look like F's. It's really hard to read. But if you're interested, it's about 268 pages, but the pagination is a little different because they were published in a format that's much smaller than an 8.5 by 11 page. So it's 268 pages. It'll take you a while to read it. It's fascinating to read, by the way. The document that I've already sent you is the Methodist version of what went on between Asbury and Kelly, but it seems to be a pretty fair treatment of the conflict between Asbury and Kelly and O'Kelly. This is what O'Kelly wrote. He wrote it under a pseudonym, Christocolus or Christocolus or something like that. Didn't publish it as Thomas O'Kelly, although it's clearly been shown that O'Kelly was the author of this. So after that's published, another man named Nicholas Sneffen, who I can't find out anything about, wrote with material that was supplied by Francis Asbury a reply to O'Kelly's apology. And then in 1801, O'Kelly just wouldn't let this issue die. And so O'Kelly published a vindicator of an apology, which is his response to what Nicholas Sneffen had produced. So if you're interested in doing the background reading, and it's complicated reading, it takes a little while to read, but I did try to give you some URLs where you can locate some of this stuff. Thomas O'Kelly was, or James O'Kelly, excuse me, was one of the earliest of the American clergymen of any sort who was concerned about the issue of slavery. Way back in 1784, O'Kelly published what's called his Essay on Negro Slavery, 1784. And here is the link to that document if you're interested in reading it. O'Kelly, along with the Quakers, tended to be the voice of religion against slavery. The Quakers were at the forefront of this. The Quakers are generally known as the group that first spoke out against slavery in the Americas. Well, he published, O'Kelly published this in 1784. It's considered one of the first arguments against slavery that was ever published by an American preacher. And there's the link to that essay. That essay is about 75 pages. That's a link that'll take you to the old style of writing. So it's a little bit hard to read. I couldn't find that in a more modern format. So questions at this point about O'Kelly and kind of his impact on the restoration.
Lee wants to know if O'Kelly ever changed his mind on baptism.
No, he did not. O'Kelly was never baptized. In fact, separated from Elias Smith over the issue of baptism. He called it, what did he call it? O'Kelly in the Apology calls baptism coming into the church through the water gate. And he is dead set against it. Yeah, O'Kelly never was baptized, never changed his position.
How were they supported monetarily?
These circuit preachers?
Yes.
I think they were supported by the individual congregations where they would go on a given Sunday. I'd have to check that out. I'd have to spend more time looking at that, Lenny. It's an interesting point. I know some of these early circuit writer preachers, one of them sticks out in my mind. His name was John Smith. They called him Raccoon John Smith. Well, he went to a place and was preaching there, and they gave him a bunch of chickens in pay. And you can imagine how that worked out when you're on horseback and your pay is a whole bunch of chickens. That didn't work very well. He had a lot to say about that. His name was Raccoon John Smith. Yeah.
I can remember when I was a kid, back in the 40s, my dad preached, went on, held a meeting. I think it was in Shafter, California. And he got paid with a used tire. one of the members of the church here gave him a car tire. And that was what he got paid for the meeting. Kind of interesting.
That might have been more useful to him than a bunch of chickens were to Raccoon John Smith.
It was fascinating.
Yeah. The issue of how they were paid didn't figure prominently in anything that I read, Lenny. I'd have to look at that. But he did argue for free will contributions. There were no, it was not a question of dues being paid to be a part of an organization, and then the organization would use those dues to support preachers, which is what happened with the Christian Association of Washington and Thomas Campbell, remember. Other questions? It is, I find it interesting that the common thread that unites Stone and Campbell and O'Kelly is opposition to church organization. They didn't leave because of the Lord's Supper or because of an issue about baptism or an issue about what the assemblies ought to look like. They left these major denominations largely because of opposition to organizations. And their response to the organizations was, well, it probably the same kind of response that I would have if I was a member of an organization and I felt like they were conducting themselves in an unbiblical way. I would form a new organization that would probably be patterned pretty much like the old one. But the difference would be that we would do things according to biblical information, not according to the Westminster Confession of Faith, like happened with the Presbyterians. So I'm fascinated by the thread that unites all of these people.
Dean?
Yeah.
Lee was asking, do you have any idea what the sizes of these congregations that they preached to were?
I don't, but let's see. I think I can, I have some images of the church at Cane Ridge where Barton W. Stone preached. And it was a small building, probably hold 75 or 100 people. And the image that I have of O'Kelly's Chapel, that's what it was called, that building is still standing, O'Kelly's Chapel. And if you go to North Carolina, you can find, they're very proud of their heritage. And you can look up the location of O'Kelly's Chapel. It's on the National Register of, or the North Carolina Register of Historic Places. And it probably would seat, and I'm guessing here, I've seen interior pictures and I've seen pictures of the outside, maybe 75, 100 people. It looked very much like what we're familiar with. If you've been to a country church, they had pews, they had a lectern in the front. Typically, they had a table for the Lord's Supper that was in front of the lectern, very much like a physical layout of a building that we're familiar with. So I don't know how many these buildings would seat. A lot of times the circuit riding preachers would hold a revival in a town, and people would come from hundreds of miles and they would camp at these revivals. They call them camp meetings. They would camp at these revivals and stay for a week. And during the day, they would have preaching. It was open air preaching. And so the size of the building where they did the most of their work may not have been as important as the size of the places where they would have these revivals. And remember, I talked about the Christian Messenger. That was a it was one of the first publications that was put out by Christians in the New World. And they would print advertisements for these revivals in the Christian Messenger, or O'Kelly had a publication, and the name of O'Kelly's publication right now escapes me, but he did pretty much the same thing. He would publish the schedule and the location of these revival meetings. And I have a feeling that those were important because it wasn't just James O'Kelly that would be preaching. There might also be somebody from the Independent Baptist Church who would be preaching. And these preachers would talk to each other, and the groups would talk to each other at these revival meetings. And so that may be the way that the word spread and these groups began to coalesce. Remember, O'Kelly and Barton W. Stone and Thomas Campbell a little bit later, they all seemed to find out about each other. But they all started independently. And this is before the internet and before you had large-scale communication. Yeah, O'Kelly's chapel is a, if you think about a country church in the Dell, it's a little white building that has the Gothic arch windows in it, and it just looks like what a little church building is supposed to look like. It is interesting, when we were in Alaska, we were trying to start a church in Barrow, and we thought, oh, no problem, we'll just meet at one of the guy's houses that lives in Barrow. Well, people wouldn't come to that because that wasn't a church building. As far as the native people were concerned, a church building was a little white building with a picket fence around the outside, and that's what it had to look like. You didn't go to church at somebody's house. You had a building. So we really struggled trying to find a place to rent in Barrow, Alaska. The best we could do was a place that would seat about 20 and had no heat. Barrow, Alaska, mind you, had no heat, no running water, and no indoor bathroom. And in 1995, they wanted to rent that to us for, Kim, was it $3,000 a week? That's a number that sticks in my head. Can't remember. Had no furnishings, had no chairs. We'd have had to bring chairs up there because to those people, a church building was a certain kind of building. And Barrow, by the way, was a Presbyterian town. Fascinating how that happened. But there was usually only one church in the town, and Barrow happened to be Presbyterian. And they had a little white building with a little picket fence around the front. And they would rent that to us, let us use it on Sunday afternoons. So you can, you can go to the North Carolina Historical Society, and you can find pictures of O'Kelly's chapel. They'll also give you the GPS coordinates for where to find his grave marker. His grave marker is in somebody's backyard, but it's a stone obelisk. Any other questions, comments? Ron, have you ever been back there and traveled through that part of the country and seen some of those places?
Arkansas. And they do have some like that. I attended a few, a little place called Bass, Arkansas, a place where my mother used to was born, Mount Judea, Arkansas. Went to a congregation where my brother and his wife went, and it had a placard up on above the door said established 1868.
Yeah.
And it was about maybe 25 or 30 people, and that was about all you could get in there.
Yep. Yep. Little bitty churches, you know, towns weren't very big back then. The church where my dad worshiped in Bowling Green, Kentucky, probably held 50 at the most. It was the only church in town. White building. We used to go to worship there, and when they had Bible classes, they put, have you seen those dividers that they used to have in hospitals, those cloth dividers on a frame? They put those out and separated the building off into four parts because the building only had one big room. Faye, you look like you had a comment.
Yes. You have to remember that the mode of transportation was horses, and the people were farmers. And so every few miles where I grew up, there was a Church of Christ because the farmers had to work, milk the cows, then get the horses, get them ready, and then get to services. And then I grew up right near Bethany, West Virginia, but across the river. So the influence of Alexander Campbell was huge.
Yeah.
And there were, even when I was living there in 1975, in one of the counties that's sparsely populated on the Ohio side, you could still find the church building like you were describing. Just you'd drive by and there would be one, and there would be maybe 20, 25 people, maybe more. And it was still, they were still worshiping in those buildings. I don't know about today. And they were all on ridges. Like you'd have Sandy Ridge and you'd have Chestnut Ridge and you'd had Hollows. And that's how you knew what congregation you were talking about, by hollows and ridges and creeks.
Yep. Town names. Either town names.
Not even towns. They weren't towns. They were like crossroads, maybe, where farmers could come from all directions to meet there. I don't know how they established that, but they would be in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
I mean, not a town. Not a town.
Yeah, farm country.
Right.
And by the way, they would meet usually in the afternoon because cows want to be milked when cows want to be milked.
Right.
So the farmers would get up, milk the cows, take care of the chores, get cleaned up, go to church, Then guess what? They had to leave and they had to go back home because they had to milk the cows and they had to do the chores in the evening. It's just the life of a farmer. That's the way it was.
Them cows can't wait.
No, they get really angry if you make them wait.
Yes, I think.
Go ahead.
And they come to church in their coveralls too.
Yes, they do. They come to church. My grandfather had his Sunday coveralls. He got a new pair of coveralls every year for Christmas, and those were the Sunday coveralls for that year. And then they got demoted to being work coveralls. And he got a new pair, not coveralls, he wore overalls, bib overalls. Got a new pair of bib overalls every year. And they just went down the line. They got worse and worse. And my grandmother kept patching them until they couldn't be patched anymore. And then they went into the cleaning rag heap.
Yeah.
Ron, your story about your dad getting a used tire, it reminded me that when my dad was younger, because there was, I would say, maybe the beginning of World War II, that he had a little Austin Healey and you couldn't get tires for it. And he would go out and buy old bicycle tires. And he would split them and put them over the outside of his tires to save the tread on the tires. So it might have been that used tire was very useful for somebody who had to drive for a meeting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, thankfully, the church here does not pay me with chickens.
Or tires.
You want chickens?
No, I'm good. I could take them home and tell Kim, hey, we eat tonight.
Well, ask Kim when you get home.
Yeah, I'll ask her. I have a feeling I know what her response would be.
I'm fascinated with what Faye was saying about the various crossroads and things like that. And it's like that everywhere in the more rural areas. People, even today, the people still have little congregations out in the middle of nowhere. Kind of fascinating. In some of the towns I ran into in Arkansas as we were traveling, very small towns, and it was kind of sad to see, but at one end of town you'd have the Church of Christ, and then at the other end of town you'd have another Church of Christ, both of them very small, but for some reason wouldn't associate with one another, I guess. I don't know.
Ron, I have a book you would probably really like to read. It's called Arkansas Angels. And it's about old preachers in Arkansas. Marvin's grandfather was one of the ones mentioned in that book. So I'll bring it to you if you'd like to read it.
I would love to read it. I can remember a gentleman coming to a preacher, coming to our house and staying and preaching for us one weekend. Named Marshall Keeble, it's a black preacher, and he stayed with us. So we held a weekend meeting just on Saturday and Sunday. But a fascinating man, just absolutely fascinating.
I heard him.
Yeah.
You've heard him.
Oh, yeah.
Fascinating man. The last time I saw him, my stepdad, Elmer, and my mom, and the kids that were home, we went to services at an Odd Fellows Hall down in the L.A. area somewhere. And I don't remember what town it was, but it was down in one of the L.A. suburbs. And it was upstairs. I remember there was a long stairwell to get up to the upstairs of that hall, and that's where we had services there. And that was the last time I saw him, but pretty fascinating man.